Chapter 3. As the second guard was racing for the door, a speck of ruby light appeared on the first guard's weapon, followed an instant later by a silenced bullet that ripped the AK-47 from his grip amid a shower of blood from his mangled hand. Juan didn't hesitate. Link or Eddie had immobilized the man from their position on the raised platform above, and Cabrillo knew they would have the stunned technician covered with their silenced Type 95 bullpup assault rifles. He wheeled and took off after the fleeing guard. He accelerated with each pace, driven by his most stubborn trait, his inability to let himself fail. The guard was disappearing into the darkened naval base, and if not for his khaki uniform, Cabrillo would have lost him in the gloom. In 8 steps, he'd cut the sentry's 2-second head start to almost nothing, and in another 3, he lunged at the fleeing Iranian, grabbing the man around the knees in a tackle that would do a professional football player proud. The two went down on the unyielding asphalt road. Juan had been protected by the guard's body, but the sentry hadn't been so lucky. His head slammed into the macadam with a sickening crunch, and their slide ripped his face open down to the muscle. Cabrillo looked around quickly. There were a couple of darkened warehouses nearby, and in the distance he could see a 4-story office building with a few illuminated windows, but he didn't think he'd been spotted. He whipped a pair of flexi-cuffs around the unconscious guard's wrists and hefted the man over his shoulder to jog back to the submarine pen. When Cabrillo closed the door behind him, he saw that Eddie had cuffed and gagged the technician. He was dragging him to the secluded corner of the entry vestibule where he'd already hidden the 2 drugged guards. Juan dumped his burden next to them. "That shaved a few months off my life," he panted. "Any chance someone saw you?" Seng asked. "If you hear an alarm start wailing, you'll have your answer. Any problems upstairs with the others?" One went for his gun. Link has stopped his bleeding, and if he gets to a hospital in the next couple of hours, he'll make it. We wore face masks, and I was shouting in Mandarin like we planned. And if those guys know their weapons, they'll recognize the Chinese-made Type 95s. Coupled with the Czech ammunition we're using, that should keep them guessing. Max Hanley sauntered over, a wry grin on his face. "You just had to make this harder than it already is, didn't you?" "Come on, Max. If we didn't up the risk, we wouldn't get the exorbitant fees we've all grown so accustomed to. I'll give up part of my cut next time. Any problem with your guy?" "His nap will last well into tomorrow. Now, if you don't mind, let's go find those torpedoes." In the first of the 2 large rooms under the elevated platform, they found a store of conventional Russian-made Test 71 torpedoes, exactly like the ones the Oregon herself carried. It was in the second room, after Link shot off the lock, that they found Iran's newest and most lethal weapon. The room was taken up with workbenches, diagnostic computers, and all kinds of electronic gear. In the middle of the space were 2 shroud-draped shapes that looked a bit like cadavers in a morgue. Max strode over to one and whipped off the sheet. At first glance, the torpedo sitting on the mechanized trolley looked like the Test 71's, except it lacked a propeller. He eyed the 25-foot underwater missile, especially its radically shaped nose. It was this feature that created a bubble of air around the torpedo and allowed it to cut through the water with virtually no friction. "What do you think?" Juan asked, approaching his second in command. "It's exactly like the pictures I've seen of the Russian Shkval," the engineer told him. "Form follows function on something like this, meaning there are only a couple of designs that would lead to the supercavitation effect, but this thing is identical to the Ruskies fish."
"So they're helping the Iranians?"
"No doubt." Max straightened.
"The proof's going to be in the design of the rocket motor, but for my money, we've got them dead to rights."
"Okay, good. You and Eddie gather everything you can."
Eddie was already at a computer terminal, jacking in a pirate drive that would siphon everything on the system. Link was looking through logbooks and binders for anything relevant. Cabrillo turned to Franklin Lincoln.
"You ready, big man?"
"Aye." Max stopped Juan from leaving the room with a hand to the elbow.
One or two.
Juan cast an eye at the two torpedoes.
In for a penny, in for a pound. Let's take them both.
You know they are most likely armed and fueled. Cabrillo grinned.
So we'll take them carefully.
While Link searched the upper platform for the mechanism that would open the main outer doors, Juan climbed up a ladder welded to one wall and walked along a catwalk to the overhead crane's control cabin. Familiar with all manner of cranes from his years at sea, he powered up the machine and started it trundling down the length of the building toward the head of the dock. As it slid back, a fiendish thought struck him, and he lowered the huge hook assembly. Weighing nearly a ton, and traveling fast enough that it had pendulumed back a couple of degrees, the hook was steered by Cabrillo toward the conning tower dive plane of Iran's newest Kilo-class submarine. The hook didn't have the momentum to rip the fin off, but the tear it left in the delicate steering control would mean the sub would remain in dry dock for the next couple of months. When Juan finally had the crane in position, Eddie and Max had wheeled one of the 3-ton torpedoes from the laboratory and out into the open. He lowered the hook, and they attached sling cables that the Iranians had thoughtfully left in place. When it was secure, Max shot Cabrillo a wave while Eddie went to retrieve his scuba gear. Cabrillo lifted the torpedo from the trolley and backed the crane out over the water again, making sure to keep it well away from the kilo. 20 feet short of the doors, he lowered the weapon into the water, watching for the thick steel cable to slacken, indicating the torpedo was resting on the bottom. He eased off the controls when the line started to bow. Eddie had walked along the jetty, lugging his tanks, helmet, and regulator. He slid into the gear and stepped off the dock. Juan watched where Eddie's bubbles popped when they reached the surface, and after a minute, Eddie's raised thumb rose through the roiling water. Juan lifted the hook free and sent the crane to return to the head of the dock once again, where Max had the second rocket torpedo in position. As the crane crawled along its rails, Juan could see Link in the upper observation area. He was bent over a computer, working the controls for the outer doors. He must have found the right combination because lights started popping off until only a single one remained illuminated above Hanley. Cabrillo looked over his shoulder. In the distance, he could just make out one of the massive doors swinging outward. That would be Linda's signal to guide the submersible into the pen. The LIDAR system would pick up the torpedo resting on the bottom, and she knew to wait for word from Cabrillo if they were going to steal another. Once the second torpedo was slung under the crane, Max joined Link, and together the two men carried the rest of their dive equipment, including Juan's scuba rig and dry suit, to the edge of the dry dock. They got ready to leave while Juan positioned the crane to lower the torpedo into the water. Once the torpedo vanished below the surface and the line went slack, he powered down the crane, reached under the small control panel, and ripped out a fistful of wires amid a shower of sparks. There was no conceivable way the Iranians wouldn't discover the theft, so the least he could do was make their job of putting the dry dock back in order as difficult as possible. Link would have set a small explosive charge to disable the computer that controlled the doors and lights and rigged it to blow on a motion sensor. To further muddy the forensic waters, the explosives and trigger were of Chinese manufacture. Remembering a detail he'd overlooked, Juan pulled the pistol from his holster and flicked it out into space, where it landed with a splash. It was a QSZ-92, the newest standard sidearm of China's People's Liberation Army. The Iranians would scour the dry dock for clues, trying to piece together who had infiltrated the base, and he was sure the pistol would be found. What they made of the evidence, he wasn't sure, but it was fun to mess with their heads. Rather than waste time laboriously climbing down off the crane, Juan scampered across the enormous I-beam that spanned the width of the building. When he reached the cable spool, he gingerly wrapped his hands around the braided cable and lowered himself, hand over hand, until he was 10 feet from the dim water, and simply let go.
Max was there with his equipment and helped Juan sling the tank over his shoulders and fit the helmet over his head.
"Linda, do you read?" Juan asked, treading water.
Because his helmet was designed to work with the dive suit Link had bundled in his arms, he wouldn't be able to use it once he was under.
"Roger, Chairman. Nice dive, by the way. From the splash, I scored a 9.2.
"Reverse double half twist with a full gainer," he deadpanned. "We've got two fish, so start recovery operations while we cycle through the airlock."
"Affirmative."
The men could feel water swirl below them as Linda crept forward in the Nomad. Without an effective dive mask, Cabrillo was guided by Link down to the airlock, and he let the chairman enter first. He wedged his considerable bulk through the tight opening, reaching over his head to secure the hatch. When an indicator on the wall turned green, he opened the valves that drained the chamber. Cabrillo yanked off his helmet as soon as the level dropped below his chin. The air was cold and crisp, refreshing after an hour of breathing the chemically tainted atmosphere trapped in the dry dock. Despite the tight quarters, he managed to wriggle out of his tank without giving Link too many bruises, so when the airlock was empty, he was ready to join Linda in the cockpit.
"Welcome aboard."
She threw him a saucy smile.
"How'd it go?"
"Piece of cake," he said absently,
sliding into the reclined seat in his wet Syrian Navy uniform. The computer monitor between them displayed a closed-circuit television shot from below the minisub. The low-light camera slung under the Nomad showed Linda that the sub was slightly off-center of the first torpedo. She made an adjustment so that one set of the curved grappling arms Max had installed were directly above the 3-ton weapon. She hit a control, and the tungsten steel claws curled around the torpedo and clamped it tight to the Nomad's belly. Juan helped her by pumping out one of the ballast tanks to regain neutral trim. Linda eased the Nomad to the side, using its directional thrusters, a corner of her lip pinched between her teeth. She cursed under her breath when the sub lurched past the torpedo.
"Tide's coming in," she explained, and reversed power to back the submersible over her target.
A light on the airlock control panel went from red to green. Eddie and Max were aboard. For the second time, the Nomad drifted beyond the torpedo, forcing Linda to ramp up the power in order to fight the tidal waters swirling into the dry dock. The eddies and cross currents played havoc with the little sub. Juan was confident that if Linda didn't think she could do it, she'd ask for his help. He let her do her job, and on the third try, she vented air and set the submersible atop the second torpedo. She closed the claws around its tubular shape and dumped more ballast. With a self-satisfied smile, Linda said, "Third time's the charm." Juan extended the manipulator arm and used its dexterous fingers to gather up the four slings they'd used to move the torpedoes and stow them in a bin under the Nomad's chin. As soon as the arm was returned to its default position, Linda jammed the joystick hard over to rotate the Nomad in the dry dock. Signals from the LIDAR system allowed her to squeak through the partially open door and into the open water of the port. Juan checked their battery status, their speed through the water, and speed over the bottom. He tapped the numbers into the computer to get an approximation of the Nomad's range. Behind them, his team was getting out of their wetsuits and dressing in fresh clothes they had packed earlier. With the tide coming in harder than they'd estimated, the little submersible would have just an hour of reserve power by the time they reached the Oregon. It was an uncomfortably close margin, and one Juan was going to make worse. He had a bad feeling about the Iranian response and wanted to put distance between his ship and the Strait of Hormuz.
"Nomad to Oregon," he radioed.
"Good to hear your voice, Chairman," Hali Kasim replied. "I take it everything went well?"
"Like stealing candy from a baby," Cabrillo said. "How's the reconfiguration going?"
"Like clockwork. The fairing over the bow is gone, the funnel's back to normal, and we've got a good jump on folding up the containers."
"Good. Holly, in about 30 minutes I want you to get underway, but take her out at about 3 knots.
the Nomad was making for. We'll make our rendezvous a little farther down the coast.
That will put us pretty close to the shipping lanes, Halley pointed out. We can't stop out there to pick you up.
I know.
We'll do the recovery on the fly.
Surfacing the Nomad in the moon pool was dangerous enough, but doing it with the Oregon underway was something Cabrillo would only risk if he felt it was absolutely necessary.
Are you sure about that?
Max asked, leaning into the cockpit. Juan turned to look his old friend in the eye.
My right ankle is acting up.
That was their code for the chairman having a premonition. He'd had the feeling before accepting an assignment from Numa that cost him his right leg below the knee, and in the intervening years, both men had come to trust Juan's instinct.
You're the boss, Max said, and nodded.
It took an additional 2 hours to reach the Oregon as she slowly steamed away from the Iranian coast. The Nomad passed under the dark hull 40 feet below the keel. The moon pool doors were fully retracted and flattened against the hull, and red battle lamps within the ship cast the water in a scarlet glow. It was almost like they were approaching the gates of hell. Linda slowed the submersible to match the Oregon's sluggish pace, centering the craft beneath the opening. In a normal recovery, divers would enter the water to secure lifting lines to the Nomad, and it would be winched into the ship. Though making only 3 knots, it was too much of a current to dive safely in the moon pool's confines. When she was comfortable with the speed, she dialed off ballast, pumping the tanks so slowly that the Nomad rose in fractional increments.
Not to add pressure or anything, Halley called over the comlink, but we have a turn coming up in less than 4 minutes.
The shipping lanes within the Strait of Hormuz were so tight that any deviation was simply not tolerated.
Yeah, that's not adding pressure, Linda replied,
never taking her eyes off her computer screens. She released more ballast, her fingers feather light on the joystick and throttle. She made tiny corrections as the opening loomed larger and larger.
You're doing great, Juan said from the co-pilot seat.
Foot by foot, the gap narrowed until the Nomad was directly below the ship. They could hear the quiet hum of her revolutionary engines and the sluice of water through her dive tubes. Linda slowed the Nomad a fraction so that it drifted back to the aft part of the moon pool, the submersible's rear fins and propellers less than a foot from the opening.
Here we go, she said, and dumped the remaining hard ballast, a hopper loaded with a half ton of metal balls.
The Nomad popped up and broached the surface. Though roiled like a cauldron because the Oregon was making 3 knots, the water in the pool was motionless in relation to the submersible. The Mini began to accelerate forward. Linda kicked on emergency reverse thrust as the little sub quickly crossed the pool, which was barely twice the sub's length. An inflatable fender that spanned the width of the pool had been lowered to the water's edge for just such a contingency. The sub hit it so softly that it barely compressed. Pairs of feet slapped down on the top of the Nomad as technicians attached lifting lines to the submersible's hardpoints. Below them, the doors were already closing. Linda let out a relieved sigh, flicking her wrists to ease the cramping. Juan patted her shoulder. He could see the strain in her eyes.
Couldn't have done it better myself.
Thanks, she said tiredly. She cocked her head as if listening to a voice in the distance.
I think I hear my bathtub calling me.
Go ahead, Juan said, sliding back off his seat and leaving a puddle on the dark vinyl.
You've more than earned it.
The team was waiting under the hatch when the Nomad was set onto its cradle and the outer lid popped open. Despite the fact he was still dripping on the non-slip floor, Juan let his team precede him out of the Mini. A tech handed him a headset without being asked.
Eric, you there?
Right here, Chairman, Eric Stone said from his place in the operations center.
As soon as the doors are closed, take us up to 18 knots. How long before we clear the strait?
2.5 hours, give or take.
And it will be another 15 hours to the rendezvous coordinates.
Cabrillo would have liked to have the torpedoes and all the technical information Eddie had pirated from the computer off the ship as quickly as possible. But the timing to meet up with the USS Tallahassee, a Los Angeles-class fast-attack submarine, had to be carefully coordinated to avoid spy satellites and the chance of a nearby ship spotting the transfer.
Okay, thanks. Tell Holly to keep a sharp ear out for military chatter coming from Bandar Abbas. If he gets anything, wake me in my cabin.
Will do, boss man.
Max was overseeing the removal of the rocket torpedoes from under the Nomad, working a chainfall himself to lower them onto motorized carts. Eddie had already placed the computer drive loaded with information into a waterproof hard case. Juan slapped one of the weapons with his palm.
$5 million apiece, plus another million for the information off the computer. Not bad for a day's work.
You should call over Holt now so he knows we nabbed two of these babies and doesn't have a heart attack when he gets our bill.
A shower first, Juan said. Then I'll call him. You turning in?
Max glanced at his watch.
It's near 4:30. I think I'm going to stay up and help out with the rest of the work to put the ship back in order. Maybe enjoy a sunrise breakfast.
Suit yourself. Good night.
The term posh originated during the time of the British Raj in India, when passengers booking ships to their imperial postings in Bombay or Delhi asked for portside cabins on the way to India and for starboard cabins on the return to England. This way, their rooms were always on the shaded side of the trip. Booking agents shortened port out starboard home to posh, and a new word entered the English language. Cabrillo's cabin was on the port side of the Oregon, but the angle the ship sailed relative to the sun allowed light to stream through his porthole and made his suite swelter despite the air conditioning. He woke, bathed in sweat, momentarily disoriented about what had roused him until he heard the phone ring a second time. He glanced at the big wall clock opposite his bed as he yanked his arms free of the twisted sheets. It wasn't yet 8, and already the sun was a torture. He lifted the handset.
Cabrillo. Chairman, it's Holly. The jig is up.
Juan did some mental calculations as the news sank in. The Oregon would be clear of the strait by now, but wouldn't have ventured very far into the Gulf of Oman. They were still very much within Iran's military sphere of influence.
What's happening? He asked,
swinging his legs out of bed and running a hand across his crew cut.
There was a burst of chatter out of Bandar Abbas about 5 minutes ago, and then nothing.
Juan had expected this. It would take some time for the base commander to figure out what had happened and finally have the courage to report the theft to his superiors in Tehran. They, in turn, would have immediately told the naval base to stop using radios and non-secure telephones and to switch to dedicated landlines. During the First Gulf War, America tipped her hand to the world concerning her eavesdropping abilities. Using its satellites and ground listening stations, the NSA could listen in on or read virtually every telephone call, radio broadcast, fax transmittal, and any other form of communication with impunity. It was how our military knew exactly where to target Saddam Hussein's command and control facilities. In response to this overwhelming technological advantage, nations who saw the United States as a threat, namely Iran, Syria, Libya, and North Korea, spent hundreds of millions of dollars building a network of landlines that couldn't be hacked or listened in on without a direct tap. After those first frantic calls that the Oregon intercepted, the Iranians had switched to this system and denied Cabrillo a valuable source of intelligence.
What did you get? Juan asked. They reported a break-in at the dry dock, a small explosion that damaged the control room, and the theft of two whales. That's their code name for the rocket torpedoes, Juan said. I think the Farsi word is hoot. That's what the computer said. After that, there was an order out of the Defense Ministry to switch to something they call the Voice of the Prophet. That'll be their military communications lines.
Juan clamped the cordless phone between his head and shoulder to free up his hands so he could dress.
Anything else? Sorry, Chairman, that was it.
Cabrillo put himself in the Iranian's shoes and thought through what would come next.
They're going to close Bandar Abbas and re-inspect every ship in the harbor. The Navy's going to be put on high alert, and they may try to stop vessels within 50 or so miles of the coast all along the Gulf of Oman.
We're still within that radius, Hali told him.
Tell the helmsman to get us the hell out. I'll be in the ops center in 2 minutes. Assemble the senior staff.
Although Juan's top people had been on duty until just a couple of hours ago, he wanted them manning the ship until they were well beyond Iran's ability to strike. When Juan had designed the Oregon, a tremendous amount of effort went into the ship's operations center. It was the brain of the vessel, the nerve center from which everything could be controlled, from her engines and weapons systems to the fire suppression sprinklers and communications. The room was as high-tech as the exterior of the Oregon was decayed. Dominating the front wall was a massive flat-panel screen that could show dozens of images at a time, from the battery of ship's cameras as well as feeds from her submersibles, the unmanned aerial ROV, and from cameras mounted on the Robinson R-44 chopper. Sonar and radar images could also be flashed onto the screen. The helm and weapons station was immediately below the flat panel, with Holly's communications console, Max Hanley's engineering station, and the principal's sonar waterfall display ringing the darkened room. In the center of the ops center was what Mark Murphy and Eric Stone had dubbed the Kirk chair. From the command position, Cabrillo could monitor everything happening on and around his ship and take over any of the other stations if necessary. With its low ceiling and the glow from dozens of computer displays, the ops center had the palpable buzz of NASA's mission control. An exhausted Max Hanley was already in his chair when Juan strode in, as was Mark Murphy. Murph was the only member of the crew without a military or intelligence background, and it showed. Tall and gawky, he had nearly black hair that was long and unkempt, and he was trying to grow a beard, although, so far, his best efforts resembled an anemic billy goat's. He possessed the highest IQ of anyone aboard ship, having gotten a PhD from MIT while still in his early 20s. From there, he had gone into systems development for a major military contractor, where he had met Eric Stone. Eric was working procurement with the Navy, but had already planned on resigning his commission and joining the corporation. During the 2 months the pair of them had spent on a still-secret long-range cannon for the Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, Eric had convinced both Cabrillo and Murph to join up as well. Juan couldn't fault Murph's proficiency with the Oregon's weapons systems. He just hoped for the day young Mr. Murphy would stop dressing in all black and playing punk music loud enough to shake barnacles off the hull. This morning found him wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with a pair of ruby lips. On the back it read, "The Rocky Horror Picture Show." His workstation was littered with half a dozen empty energy drink cans, and Juan could see by the glassy look in Murph's eye he was mainlining on caffeine. Cabrillo took his seat and adjusted the computer display at his elbow. A steaming cup of coffee materialized at his side. Maurice had approached so silently Juan never heard him coming.
I'm going to have to put a bell on you.
To employ an overused cliché, Captain, over my departed corpse.
Or dead body, whatever.
Juan smiled.
Thanks. You are most welcome, sir.
Over the rim of his coffee, Juan studied the displays in front of him, especially noting the radar picture of the surrounding waters. The coast of Iran still showed at the top of the screen, at the radar's extreme limit, while around them countless ships were heading into and out of the Persian Gulf. From the size of the returns, he knew most of them were tankers, and the traffic seemed as thick as Atlanta at rush hour. Far to the south was a cluster of ships around one large vessel he guessed was an American aircraft carrier task force. He checked their speed and heading, as well as the depth of the water under the ship. The bottom had dropped to 400 feet, plenty deep enough for a lurking Iranian sub. But with the Americans so close, he was more concerned with a helicopter or aircraft assault, if they were linked to the theft somehow. A quick glimpse at the camera displays showed him that the Oregon looked as she should, with her single funnel and decks devoid of containers. Her name was back to normal, though he noted the Panamanian flag still flew from her jackstaff. A prudent precaution, because the Iranians wouldn't need permission to board a ship flying their ensign, as the Oregon normally did. The mast camera high atop one of the cargo derricks showed a tanker they must have passed recently, less than a mile astern, and a container ship streaming along their track a half mile to the north.
Holly, anything on sonar?
Except for the noise from 8 ships within range that the computer's already scrubbed, there's nothing out here but us innocent merchantmen.
He paused, as if to add something. Juan saw his frown and said,
Tell me. No matter how small.
About a minute after communications from Bandar Abbas went dead, there was a burst of transmission from the naval base at Chabahar.
Have you heard it since?
Holly shook his head.
Just that one time.
Juan wasn't sure what to do with that piece of information, so he let it go for the moment.
What about aircraft or helos?
An ASW plane off the carrier to our south did pass an hour ago, but nothing from our friends to the north.
Cabrillo relaxed slightly and was beginning to think they might get away with it after all. It was just as that thought entered his mind that Holly shouted,
Sonar contact! Bearing 95 degrees, 7,000 yards! Torpedo in the water!
Damn it! He was waiting to ambush us, with his bow doors open and his tubes flooded.
There was more than 5 miles separating the ship from the incoming torpedo, so Juan knew he had more than enough time to get the Oregon out of danger. His voice remained calm.
Track it, Holly. Let's make sure we know where it's going before we react.
Sonar contact, Kasim cried again. Second torpedo in the water, same bearing and range. I'm getting target extrapolation off the computer. The first fish is heading for the container ship. I have her identified as the Saga, and she left Bandar Abbas 20 minutes before we did.
The tactical picture went from bad to worse.
We're getting a warning from the carrier battle group, Holly called out. They heard the shots and are launching aircraft.
This is turning into a hell of a furball, Max said sardonically.
Tell me about it, Juan muttered.
Come on, Holly shouted. New contact. They launched a third torpedo. It's looking like a spread pattern targeting us, the Saga, and the tanker behind us, a Petromax Oil ULCC named the Aggie Johnston.
Had there been just the one torpedo tracking the Oregon, Cabrillo could have handled it. Maybe even two, if he could put his vessel between the second one and the ship it had targeted. But with 3 fish in the water, his options had quickly run out. Either the Saga or the Aggie Johnston was going to take a direct hit. And with a full load of 200,000 tons of Gulf crude, there was no way he would let it be the supertanker.
They just launched another, Holly said with disbelief in his voice. That's 4 fish in the water. Range between the Saga and the first is down to 6,000 yards. This last fish is going much slower than the others.
It's lurking to see what the others miss, Max said, and we'll go in to finish it off. If one of the first 3 torpedoes missed or failed to detonate, this reserve salvo would be in position to destroy its intended target. Cabrillo was familiar with the tactic. He also had no defense against it. He was now thinking they would be lucky to get out of the Sea of Oman alive.